free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Friday, April 4th, 2014. Alexander Hamilton is the topic of conversation today with Tom DiLorenzo. Tom is the author, of course, of The Real Lincoln, Lincoln Unmasked, How Capitalism Saved America, and other favorites. And one of those favorites will be, once you read it, his book Hamilton's Curse, How Jefferson's Arch Enemy Betrayed the American Revolution and What It Means for America Today. Tom is a professor of economics at Loyola University in Maryland, where he joins us today. Tom, thanks for being here.
Pleased to be with you again, Tom.
Today, the subject is not Abraham Lincoln, but Alexander Hamilton, who nevertheless appears to be, we might say, a distant cousin in certain respects. But I want you to start off by giving us the overview of how the establishment portrays Hamilton. Because Hamilton's a hero to everybody. He's a hero in the mainstream left. He's a hero to the mainstream right. He's a hero to the mainstream middle. He's a hero to everybody. So what is it that they see in this guy? Like, what's their best argument for him?
The arguments they make for him was, well, he was a Revolutionary War hero, which I suppose is true. And then, when they talk about economics, they say that his economic program created good credit for the U.S. government. And some of the people, some of the authors I've read, even said that he actually created capitalism by promoting the sale of government bonds somehow. Somehow the sale of government bonds and government borrowing magically created the stock market so that we could have capitalism. And Michael Lind is one person who has said that, and David Brooks of the New York Times has said that. And it's complete nonsense, of course. The stock market existed long before Hamilton came around and started hawking government bonds for the Northeastern moneyed elites, which is what he was doing. And so that's the main claim, is that he created sort of the economic edifice of America that made America great.
So let's go back now to the 1790s and look at the sorts of things that he proposed. Now, he didn't get everything he wanted. He wanted a much higher tariff, for instance, than they wound up giving him. But he did get his national bank, and I think he got some other stuff. So let's look one at a time, one item at a time, at the Hamilton program. Let's start with the biggie, which is the National Bank. And let's leave aside the constitutional controversy. We'll get to that later. He gets the National Bank in the face of the opposition of Thomas Jefferson. What difference does this make? I mean, isn't the National Bank of the 1790s a bit of trivial nothingness compared to the Federal Reserve of today?
I guess it certainly is, but this was where the idea got started. You know, the great debate between Hamilton and Jefferson was, for a long time, all about the propriety of having a bank run by politicians out of the nation's capital. Jefferson, of course, thought that was a horrific idea. But the basic model of Hamilton and his party, the Federalist Party, was to bring the rotten, corrupt British mercantilist system to America. And the Jeffersonians said, well, wait a minute, we just fought a revolution against that rotten, corrupt, mercantilist system, the British Empire. But the position of Hamilton and his cohorts was always, this is a good system as long as we are in charge and as long as we can profit from it. So they wanted to be on the receiving end of all the pelf and the money that was gathered by the state and its allies from a mercantilist system. And a mercantilist system is basically a system of policies that benefits businesses and producers at the expense of consumers and everybody else. So that's why Jefferson saw this as a mortal threat, not only to the American economy, but to American freedom, because they had just fought a revolution against that type of tyranny. And so that's why Hamilton wanted a bank run by politicians of the nation's capital.
Can you explain why Hamilton or anybody else would view the national debt as a, quote, national blessing, which I think is where you got the title of your book, Hamilton's Curse, from, that instead of him or the debt being a blessing, it's a curse?
Right. Yeah, the idea for the book was it was sort of a counter to a book by John Steele Gordon called Hamilton's Blessing, A History of the Public Debt. And Hamilton did say once that the public debt could be a national blessing if it's not too excessive. And then, of course, he spent the rest of his life making the government borrowing as excessive as possible, both in his actions as Treasury Secretary and as his behavior as a writer and a speaker. And he constantly complained to George Washington and anyone else who would listen that the government did not have enough energy, as he said. He wanted the government to be an imperial power like the British Empire. He wanted it basically to be unlimited by a constitution, which is why he condemned the constitution as a frail and worthless fabric, because it did not centralize power in the nation's capital and create more or less unlimited power. And so that's where Hamilton was coming from as far as the debt goes. He understood that the debt would be owned by the wealthier people of the country, and he very explicitly said that in a very Machiavellian way, that if the wealthier people of the country own the debt, they will become a political force for bigger government and higher taxes forever, because they will want to make sure that there's enough money in the Treasury always to pay off their bonds. And so he was very Machiavellian about that. And so he didn't think of that. He didn't say that the public debt, a big public debt, would be good for the country, good for the consumer, good for the taxpayer. He said it would be good for growing government far beyond what the Constitution would allow it to be.
Last night, Tom, I had a Q&A, a live video Q&A session on my site, and somebody raised the excellent point that there's a lot of confusion about who the supporter of genuine capitalism or laissez-faire was in the 1790s. People portrayed Jefferson as this sort of backwater, maybe semi-reactionary, agrarian, nostalgic for simpler times, whereas you have Hamilton, the full-throated capitalist. But is that true? Like, how was that? In what sense could that be true? Doesn't it seem to be that the opposite would be true?
Yes, the opposite is, in fact, true. Hamilton was pretty much of an economic ignoramus. The great William Graham Sumner, the great Yale University libertarian sociologist of the late 19th century, wrote a biography of Hamilton, and he said that Hamilton was befogged in the mysticism of mercantilism. You know, he grew up in the island of St. Croix, working for British slave-owning molasses traders, who benefited from the British mercantilist system, and he wanted to be wealthy like them. And how did they get wealthy? Well, they got wealthy through political connections. And Hamilton, Sumner says, probably never read Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. What he did know or say or write about economics came from sort of propaganda pamphlets from British mercantilists. Sir James Stuart was one of them. And these are people who just wrote rationales or excuses for crony capitalism or mercantilism in England, and that's what Hamilton knew. Whereas Jefferson, on the other hand, was very well-schooled. He read The Wealth of Nations. He translated from French the work of Turgot, the French finance minister, who was a member of the so-called physiocrat school of thought, which was a precursor to the Austrian school of free market of economics. And so if you walk into Monticello tomorrow and look to your left, you'll see a big bust of Turgot. And so he read Ricardo. He knew all of the economic writings of his day, whereas Hamilton seemed to know nothing of this. And so it really is a big, fat lie that Jefferson was this sort of backwoods agrarian. Another sort of corollary lie is that Jefferson did not want banks. I've read this over and over again. he wasn't opposed to banks, and he wasn't opposed to industrialization either, which some of his critics say. What he was opposed to is basically taxing the farmers of the country and using their tax dollars to subsidize politically connected corporations. That's what he was opposed to. He was opposed to mercantilism, but he was a capitalist in terms of genuine capitalism.
You know, Tom, your description of mercantilism and Hamilton's views and Hamilton's so-called economic education, which consisted of reading pamphlets of no real intellectual significance, puts me in mind of what Rothbard said in his History of Economic Thought about mercantilism. Now, here's Rothbard, who's gone through the whole history of economic thought from ancient Greece all the way up through the 19th century. And he treats everybody with respect, trying to find some nugget of wisdom. But when he gets to mercantilism, he absolutely refuses to consider this a school of economic thought. It is no such thing. It is a grandiose rationalization of the enrichment of particular parties, and it is nothing else. It is not a school of thought, and so I'm not going to dignify it by treating it that way. I was just blown away to get to that. He will not do it. And so that's very helpful, I think, when we think about Alexander Hamilton. Well, now, on the tax and the tariff issue, though, it's true that Hamilton doesn't get the high tariffs, the protective tariffs that he wants right away. But long after Hamilton is dead, after the War of 1812, you have all these manufacturing interests that have grown up during the war, and now that trade has been resumed with Europe and with the British, they're afraid they're not going to be able to compete, so they demand tariffs. And the tariff of 1816 is the first protective tariff. It's not as high as some that will come later, but it's the first protective tariff in U.S. history. And a lot of people will say, Tom, that that is what really drove the development of the U.S. economy, that you economists can rant and rave all you want about free trade, but the fact is the U.S. became a powerhouse behind a protective tariff wall.
Yeah, well, I've heard that argument many times, but point number one is that in 1816, international trade probably accounted for maybe 5 or 6% of the whole U.S. economy. So if there was a protectionist tariff, it only affected a very tiny part of the U.S. economy. And so that to the extent there was economic development, it had to be caused by something else other than any kind of protectionist tariff. And also, the point number two would be, well, a protectionist tariff always impoverishes a country. It benefits those who are protected from competition, but harms others. Example today, when President George W. Bush put a 35% tariff on steel, it was very harmful to the car manufacturers and any other business that used steel. And the same thing was true in 1816. You know, the people who used protected, so-called protected goods to manufacture other goods with were made worse off, and the people, of course, were made poorer by being forced to pay higher prices for those things. And so that argument is a classic post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy. After this, therefore because of this. The chicken crows in the morning, the sun comes up, therefore the chicken crowing causes the sun to come up. And so they say, we had a tariff, we had economic growth, therefore the tariff causes economic growth. But if you understand elementary economics, you know that that's just a very foolish and dangerous idea.
Now, Tom, we can tell from Alexander Hamilton's proposals for the new U.S. government what his sympathies were politically. He favored a president who would serve for life, senators who would serve for life, governors appointed by the president. He wants political centralization. He wants a robust central authority. And that's going to show up, of course, in the way he tries to interpret the Constitution once the suckers have gone ahead and ratified it. Now, beforehand, well, he's all tears and pity about the making sure that this government will stay limited and so on and so forth. And this, in fact, at one point he says, well, of course, agriculture is not part of general welfare. That'll be a local concern. Then as soon as it passes, he says, well, of course, agriculture falls under the federal government's purview. So he's basically a liar and a manipulator to get what he wants. But starting with that national bank controversy, we see the Hamiltonian version of constitutional interpretation. What is it?
Well, the Hamiltonian interpretation of constitutionalism is that the Constitution can and should be interpreted by clever lawyers like Hamilton, to put a rubber stamp on virtually anything the government would ever want to do. Whereas the Jeffersonian view is that the Constitution, the government should be bound by the chains of the Constitution, as Jefferson himself once said. And but Hamilton was the one who invented the idea of implied powers in the Constitution during his debate with Jefferson over the constitutionality of a national bank. And Jefferson's position was essentially, he didn't use this word, but essentially, I've looked between the lines and there's blank space there. But Hamilton kept making the look, you've got to look between the lines argument. And of course, once you go down that road, then government really is unlimited. The only thing that limits it is the imagination of politicians and how to spend the taxpayers' money. And so when I first started writing about Hamilton on lewrockwell.com, I had an email from a law student at New York University thanking me. He said, you know, I'm sitting here in Nadine Strossen's constitutional law class, and for several weeks now we've been learning the Hamiltonian interpretation of the Constitution, which is basically a big, long list of case law that makes arguments for why the Constitution should be neutered or ignored. And he said, thanks for, you know, at least being one person who is criticizing this view that I'm aware of.
Now, what about John Marshall, who seems to be, again, kind of intellectually a kind of cousin of Hamilton's? John Marshall's another guy who is universally revered. And, of course, Rothbard reminds us that you should always be wary of a politician, a government official who's universally revered. Like, that always means trouble, right? Well,
yes,
in this case of Marshall, again, you have left liberals who support Marshall. So anytime I talk about nullification, they immediately, the same people who say we can't be bound by what dead white males say, well, as long as that dead white male's name is John Marshall, we're going to quote him until the cows come home. So you got the left doing that. And then the right, they think he was a man of property and he was a man of order against the chaotic Jacobins of the of Jefferson's party. It's like the right gets played this way all the time. They get played with this sort of propaganda that directs them away from people who should be their natural allies into the hands of people who are just exploiting them. Now, that having said all that, what's the problem fundamentally with John Marshall? He's the Chief Justice from 1801 to 1835, in case people don't know, and he is considered to be maybe the most important Chief Justice ever.
Yes, he probably is. You know, one indication of that is there's an excellent book by Ivan Elin called "Recarving Rushmore," and he judges all the presidents and ranks them according to how good a job they did in protecting the life, liberty, and property of the American citizens. And he gives John Adams a very, very low ranking. But the main reason he gave for giving John Adams such a very low ranking was he appointed John Marshall to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, nice.
Chief Justice, and so. Marshall was a slavish devotee of Alexander Hamilton's political philosophy and legal philosophy. And so he believed in the Hamiltonian notion that the Constitution can be a rubber stamp in almost anything government wanted to do. And that's how he magically discovered that a national bank was constitutional after all, even though, as the Jeffersonians pointed out, the issue was discussed at the Constitutional Convention, that is, the propriety of a national bank, and it was rejected. It was clearly rejected, but he made that up. And then, of course, it was John Marshall who declared that judicial review is the purview of the U.S. Supreme Court, which really meant him, and that he would be the final arbiter of all things constitutional, and American politicians and the public didn't really accept that until it was forced onto them after the Civil War and during the Civil War. But prior to the so-called Civil War, a lot of American politicians thought that we had three branches of government. The president and the Congress also had a say on constitutional matters, as did the people of the states. But have a say. Andrew Jackson responded to Marshall's opinion on the bank by simply saying, in effect, thanks for your opinion, but my opinion is different, and my opinion is just as important as your opinion. And so the Jeffersonians had long been warning that the day ever came that the federal government became the sole arbiter of the limits of its own powers by interpreting the Constitution, that Americans would live under a tyranny. And John Marshall did more than anyone to bring about that view through a so-called judicial review. He also did what Hamilton did in some of his opinions and started rewriting American history by claiming that the states were never sovereign, by claiming that the Constitution somehow never came about through state political conventions, but came about somehow by some sort of plebiscite by the whole people. Mm. And he repeated this language of the whole people to justify a national government. He also twisted the meaning of the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, which gives the federal government supremacy only in those things in Article 1, Section 8, the things, the legitimate constitutional functions of the government, not everything under the sun. And so this idea that the federal government is always and everywhere supreme over everyone and everything, that got started with John Marshall. And so I guess you can begin to see why Ivan Eland dislikes John Adams so much for having appointed him. And you mentioned the word cousin, by the way, Tom, and he was, I think, a second cousin of Jefferson, ironically.
Ah, of Jefferson, indeed. Yeah. Let me add one other thing about Hamilton. In McCulloch versus Maryland, 1819, which is a decision, by the way, that when he heard about it, James Madison said, if the people had known the Constitution would be interpreted this way, they would never have ratified it. In that decision, among other things, Marshall made quite a lot out of the fact that the 10th Amendment did not have the word expressly in it, expressly delegated, which had been present in the Articles of Confederation. He tried to make something out of this, knowing full well that at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, of which he was a participant, he was a member of that, he was there, the people were told that even before there was a 10th Amendment, as written, the Constitution already meant that the federal government had only the powers expressly delegated. And that's what matters, is the meaning that was put on the Constitution at the Ratifying Convention. He knew that, and he's still peddling the opposite. And we're supposed to respect this guy and not dare to contradict him. I think you'd be a fool not to contradict him. Tom, the full title of your book, Hamilton's Curse, the subtitle is How Jefferson's Arch Enemy Betrayed the American Revolution and What It Means for America Today. What does it mean for America today?
Well, Hamilton was the founding father of unlimited government, and he was the founding father of crony capitalism in America. And that is exactly the system that we all suffer under today. It's the cause of the Great Recession of 2008. It's the cause of runaway Fed arrogance, printing money wildly, creating never-ending boom and bust cycles. It's the cause of why we have a dictatorial president who thinks he can write any law he wants and send drones to murder American citizens anywhere on the planet on a whim without any interference from Congress or anyone else. That's the Hamiltonian curse. And, of course, Hamilton's defenders would say, well, if he were alive today, he wouldn't want them to go that far. But that's really a naive view. You know, Hamilton understood how politics works, and he understood how power works. And he had to have known himself that if you really did have an unlimited government restrained only by the goodwill of politicians, you know, what a ludicrous joke that is, that it would become tyrannical. And I think he was always just extremely short-sighted and wanted nothing but power and for himself and his friends. And I think, you know, further evidence of that is that as soon as his friends did get power, when the Federalists got John Adams, their man, as president, what did they do? Then one of the first things they did was to abolish free political speech in America with the Sedition Act. And that's the kind of people Hamilton's party was. He was the intellectual leader of that party.
Well, the book is Hamilton's Curse by Thomas J. DiLorenzo, a major part of your re-education. I always hate that. Re-education sounds so Stalinist. I hope people understand what I mean. But, Tom, thanks for being here again. We always appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom. I'm always glad to be with you.
All right, everybody, make sure and check out Hamilton's Curse. I have posted all the logistical details now for my upcoming events, April 9th at Florida Southern College, April 10th at Liberty University, April 26th at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and May 9th in Provo, Utah. You can find out the details there at tomwoods.com. On the events page, tomwoods.com/events. Remember, we're celebrating 2 years of libertyclassroom.com, where you can learn the history and economics they didn't teach you with a special blowout deal, 50% off with coupon code DISCOUNT in all caps. Check that out over at libertyclassroom.com. All right, that's it, everybody. Another week of programs is behind us. Make sure you're subscribing, by the way. Before I let you go, let me badger you guys about this. No real need to, but why not? On iTunes or Stitcher or anywhere you like to get podcasts, you can subscribe to this program and make sure you don't miss any of these precious gems that we are releasing Monday through Friday. You can subscribe easily by using the subscription links over at TomWoodsRadio.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next week.
The Tom Woods Show.